With the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic and the added stressors on children, youth, and families, more attention has been focused on the impact of adverse childhood experiences on the mental health and wellness of British Columbians. Research that started in the 1990s has shown a correlation between the number of ACEs in a young person's life, such as abuse, neglect, and family dysfunction, and an increased risk of mental health and substance use disorders and other chronic diseases. Research shows a physiological and neuroscientific link between trauma experienced as a child and the health and well-being of adults. The good news is there are ways that physicians can help to mitigate and address these challenges. I'm Marissa Adair, and today on our Doctors of BC podcast, we welcome Dr. Linda Ueda, a BC family physician whose personal journey of self-discovery led to her interest in the mind-body connection and the impact of adverse childhood experiences and how they link to that. Linda has incorporated her learnings on ACEs into her medical practice, and today we're going to discuss the long-term impact of ACEs and what physicians can do to address and mitigate the impact on their patients. Welcome to the show, Linda.
Thank you so much, Marissa. I'm really happy to be here, and I'm excited that we're talking about this topic today.
Can you maybe start by explaining to us what exactly are adverse childhood experiences?
So there was a study published in 1998 by Drs. Felitti and Anda, and it was a study that looked at multiple events that would happen in a child's life before the age of 18. And so there were actually more experiences that were studied just beyond what ended up being incorporated into the published article. But essentially what it showed was that the more accumulated traumatic events that a child had, there was a direct dose response relationship between the amount of adversity and the decades later effects on mental health and physical health. So it was remarkable information. It was eye-opening. And so I only learned about this several years ago, but my journey into this information started really with my family and with having my children. And so I started to learn this information really in an effort to help me decide how I was going to parent. And so it's been a journey. I still feel like I'm really at the beginning of my understanding and my learning, but understanding all of these things now that we have the evidence for. We have scientific evidence that is pointing us in the direction that all of these things that as a physician, maybe we once felt were airy, fairy, fluffy stuff, really does have a bearing on the outcomes for our patients and ourselves.
So from a physiological neuroscience perspective, exactly how do these adverse childhood experiences actually translate into chronic disease or mental health issues?
I think the biggest learning point for me didn't happen in my medical school training, my undergrad. It came about when I was going to these parenting courses, when I was learning about the neuroscience of development. And the way I have come to understand it is that our nervous systems are really underformed when we're first born. So this gives us an opportunity to then match our nervous system to the environment in which we are raised. And so as we grow up, we're learning about what we need to do in order to survive in the environment in which we find ourselves. So I think probably the most profound understanding came about when I more fully understood the autonomic nervous system. The autonomic nervous system, you know, if we remember back to our training, is just that. It's autonomic. It's automatic. It's below our consciousness. And so when stressful things happen to us, our reactions are very reflexive. And so all of these things, this cascade of things that happen in our body when we mount a stress response happens almost instantaneously like a reflex. So the way I teach this is if you can, you know, imagine yourself walking down the hallway and all of a sudden your brother, your sister, your child jumps out of a doorway and yells boo at you and you feel that adrenaline rush. Well, in that instant of an adrenaline rush, your heart rate speeds up, your blood pressure rises, the sugar in your blood increases, your muscles tense and they tighten. And It's your body's way of giving you that extra energy that you need to either fight or run. It's provided instantaneously. So what also happens is our bodies are really wise, and it realizes that, okay, we can't do everything at once. So other systems are shut down. Our digestive system is shut down. Our sexual response system changes. And that's all an effort to do in that moment what is most likely going to be a life-saving event. And so that all made sense to me. But the real kicker for me was that this system, because it's developed so early on and it is primitive, there's not a lot of understanding going on. And so whether it's a physical threat or an emotional threat, that system doesn't know the difference. And so if we are under an emotional threat, you know, being something like, well, I don't have enough food to eat, I'm not getting protected in instances where there's trauma around me, those emotional threats also set off that system. So if you can imagine then, if a child is being raised in an environment where they constantly feel unsafe, unsupported, unloved, their systems are going to be going off all of the time. And so in essence, what happens is our nervous system becomes sensitized, you know, going into that stress response more often. That can be life-saving in situations where I do need to fight, I do need to run. But over time, if you can imagine, if I put my heart rate up, we call that tachycardia. If I put my blood pressure up, we call that hypertension. If I leave my sugar on for too long, it translates to diabetes. And so these effects that are learned really in our earliest years are carried forward into our life. And unless we learn new skills and new ways of being in the world, and those new skills and those new ways of being almost require that we learn them in concert with another human being. That's where my understanding really shifted as a physician.
How did you go about bringing this understanding of the impact of ACEs into your practice? Can you give us an example of how a situation or dynamic with a patient may be altered by this understanding?
Right. So using what I was learning as a parent and having experience using this with my children, a friend and I were kind of laughing about it when we were talking about clinical practice. For me, it all comes down to parenting. So the way I interact with my children is also the way now I interact with my patients, my coworkers, my husband. The relational part of that is all the same. For example, you know, I work at the Forensic Psychiatric Hospital, and in my setting, we have patients with huge amounts of trauma in their backgrounds. And so when I see a patient acting out, being aggressive, in days gone by, the approach would be to punish, right? We're going to put you in seclusion. We're going to lock you away until you calm down, until you can regulate yourself and come back into the group again. And so now, through the lens of trauma, understanding that that stress response is telling me something, I can approach this in a different way. So now I know that if somebody is dysregulated, they need another person to help them calm down. You know, the other really interesting thing that I've learned is that people with traumatic histories, attachment insecurity, they're more, like I said, they're more sensitized to stress. And it's almost like they've got a radar that's looking out for it all the time. And so for me as a physician, I need to understand that I may think that I'm coming into a certain situation and I'm exuding safety and I'm being calm, and I may not realize that I'm actually triggering the patient. Maybe I'm talking too swiftly, maybe I'm talking too loudly, maybe I'm moving too quickly, or there's something else that's happening in the environment that is escalating my patient. So whenever I go into those situations where I feel this dysregulation, I have to check myself. I have to make sure I'm centered. And then it's like a dance, being with that person inside that room. You know, if I try something and it's not working and their behavior is escalating, I need to respond to that and back off and change my tactic. So it's something that I use on a daily basis. And I was talking to medical students the other day and saying, you know what, this is trial and error. I didn't learn this information overnight. It's been a growth. It's been practicing with people. It's learning what works. and the way I feel inside those interactions now compared to when I first started my career almost 20 years ago, it is so much more fulfilling to be able to work with people in this manner. Because often I can help co-regulate my patients. I can help settle them and bring them to a point where they can hear what I'm saying, where we can have a discussion.
You gave me a powerful example earlier. It was simple, but yet very powerful, about a young patient you had who was having challenges around breathing. And can you share that one with us?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, when we talk about trauma, we often talk about the fact that, well, it's really important to have this longitudinal relationship with our patients. But I also work in a youth clinic setting. And so there are times when I don't have that longitudinal relationship, and the youth is just coming in for birth control. And this particular patient, that's what happened. She came in to refill her birth control prescription. And in the midst of that, you know, we were just talking about her life and talking about how things were going with COVID. And she was saying, well, I'm doing fairly well, but I struggle, you know, sometimes with my breathing. And I said, oh, tell me a little bit more about that. And she said, well, it's really frustrating because I've discussed this with my GP. My GP sent me to a respirologist. I've had breathing tests done, and everybody's telling me that it's normal. I'm fine. There's nothing wrong. So with that, I spent a few minutes with her, just educating her about that stress response, right? Because when we become stressed, we breathe more quickly. And I told her, you know, sometimes when we have stressful things that have gone on in our childhoods, we're more likely to be flipped over into the sense of fight or flight, and, you know, our breathing can be affected. And she just looked at me with this expression of relief, saying, this makes total sense to me. And she disclosed to me, I was raised in the foster system. That is more how I use ACEs in my practice. I don't screen for them on a regular basis, but I'm aware of them. We don't need to do a deep dive into our patient's past history in order to help them. If we sense that this is what's going on with our patient, that gives us an opening to start discussing these things. Over and over again, I have had that experience where I explain the physiology of stress and trauma, and you can palpably feel the relief in the patient because they feel validated that these are experiences that they are truly having in their body, and that they're real and they come from somewhere.
It sounds like what I'm hearing is that it's really important to ask questions and listen and get to know your patients. Is that the advice you would give to doctors who want to start thinking about ACEs and perhaps just start to integrate it into their practice?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the ACEs study to me is a very small part of addressing trauma-informed practice. So I have had patients that, you know, have an ACE score of 0 and yet they're still struggling. And so I'm trying to help physicians and teachers and community members understand more about attachment theory as well, because you can have 0 ACEs, but have attachment insecurity, and it can show up in many of the same ways. So essentially the science is the same, but you can have micro traumas inside a relationship with your primary caregivers that also lead to these changes. The beautiful thing about all of this information is it also gives us an opportunity to heal. I don't know a single person who isn't impacted by trauma and attachment. It is so widespread. The attachment literature essentially shows that in North America, 45 to 50% of us are insecurely attached. So that's huge.
Is there a fear that in taking this approach, some physicians may be triggered themselves with respect to their own childhood experiences?
I have definitely talked to some physicians who have that concern, but I would say that if we don't recognize what is going on, we are actually probably being triggered on a regular basis without having that knowledge, without having that explicit knowledge. So if I have somebody in my office who is, as you know, we would call difficult, they're acting out, they're raising their voices, they're coming at us. If I myself have a traumatic history, if I myself have experience with somebody coming at me in that manner, I'm going to be triggered. And I'm not likely going to be able to respond in a way that is helpful to that person. So like I said, this is a long journey, but in my life, in my personal life and in my practice life, the things that I have learned, the counseling that I have done has been profoundly helpful in all areas of my life.
There's been a lot in the news, and Canadians are really reeling from the discovery of the remains of Aboriginal children at the residential school site in Kamloops. How does adverse childhood experience work when it is actually a generational, when an entire generation or generations of people are impacted by a common adverse childhood experience?
So, you know, this is something that I was born and raised in Kamloops. I could see the residential school across the river from where I grew up. And so when I learned about this, I know, you know, I could feel, it felt like a gut punch. Somebody hit me in my body. So I can only imagine how our Indigenous people, our First Nations people have felt to have that wound reopened. What I need to do is I need to bear witness to all of that and not insert what I think needs to happen and what I think that community needs to heal. We need to listen to them right now. Again, it comes down to that attachment dynamic. I need to listen. I need to hear the truth. I need to validate that that happened. So just saying again, I don't need to open up all of those old wounds with patients who've experienced that trauma. I need to recognize that it is there. I need to understand the physiologic changes, the risks that come with experiencing those kinds of traumatic events, and then bring some compassion to the problems that I see in front of me then, to the people that I work with. And I don't need to have them explain to me their whole story. So within my own family, you know, both sets of my grandparents went through the Japanese Canadian internment. And so I'm still, as a granddaughter of those people, trying to understand what that means to me, how that shaped me, you know, from parents who were raised during that time. And so if I look at it from that point of view, because I'm not Indigenous, you know, my family doesn't have that history, what I want people to understand is that it happened. It happened to people that I care about and people that I loved, and I still see effects of it within my own family.
How can doctors begin to establish trust and rapport with their patients to really work through these challenges?
So I would say, you touched on it, Marissa, you know, just listening and hearing what's important to our patient. You know, so as physicians, we learn all of these algorithms. We have all of these things that we want to meet with our patients. We have, you know, the hemoglobin A1C that we want to get down to. We have the blood pressure targets that we want to get to. But if you understand attachment theory, you have to understand that the influence has to go both ways. The trust, the mutual respect has to go both ways. In my interactions, you know, I often try to find out what's important to you in your life right now. You know, so asking that young girl, tell me how COVID is affecting you. You know, tell me how that plays out in your regular life. You know, then you're allowing them to lead the conversation, to lead their care, because maybe their goal isn't to have, you know, a perfect hemoglobin A1C. So I need to listen to that as a physician.
It's great to hear that there are ways for physicians and others to help patients mitigate the impact of ACEs. But what can we do to prevent adverse childhood experiences?
It's interesting for me, as I've learned this information, I constantly have to keep taking a step back. And so what I mean by that is, okay, we see the trauma. And then, you know, early in my learning, I was like, okay, well, it's about the parents then, right? If the parents were there to support their child, and buffer them from these things, then would be okay. Well, no, wait a second. What if that parent doesn't have the skills? What if they don't have the resources? What if they don't have, you know, the money or the food to support their child? So then we need to back up some more. We need to back up and say, what are the community resources for this? What is the culture willing to do to support this? And then we need to back up even more into, what is the government willing to do? I belong to the Child and Youth Mental Health and Substance Use Collaborative. And there is that link where we are working with you know, the Ministry of Health. We are trying to change policy. We are trying to educate people, even in the family justice system, to understand trauma and the impacts and the influences of all of these decisions that are made so high up. Having said that, those things are going to take time to change. So there are things that we can all do on an individual basis to try to shift this at a grassroots level as well. By that, I mean one interaction at a time, right? Even having an interaction with a mother with a young child, temper tantruming in the grocery store, in the lineup in front of me, I can show her compassion and say, you know what? I've been there. It's hard. So I have hope. And once you understand this information, you cannot go back. So I think that this information will only help us grow compassion and empathy and understanding for all of us.
Ultimately, understanding ACEs and incorporating it into a physician's practice, is it good for the physician too, in terms of their own physician, their own health and well-being?
Mm-hmm. I definitely believe it's protective. So the more I am able to see that I have a positive effect on my patient, the more enjoyable my work is, right? But if I'm just on that hamster wheel and I'm seeing patient after patient and I'm trying to make my goals be heard and I'm seeing that it's futile, I'm at much higher risk for feeling like I'm not making a difference. I'm not making a big impact on anyone. So like I said, as I have brought this into my own practice, my sense of feeling like I can actually do something to actually help people heal, not just to patch up their blood pressure or improve their diabetes or give them a medication to help their depression. I'm actually helping them heal. So that is where that's where my bucket gets filled up.
Is this taught in medical schools? Are today's young doctors gaining an understanding of this?
So I just had a teaching session with medical students, but it doesn't seem to be across the whole school. It's really sporadic. These were medical students who came to our community of practice and said, we want this information. We want to offer it to other students. But in my humble opinion, this is foundational to what we do as physicians. And if we want to be healers, we have to understand this information. So our goal is that it becomes, you know, a big part of the curriculum for all physicians across BC.
In the meantime, what can doctors do and where can they turn to get more information about ACEs?
I'm part of the CYMHSU community of practice. That's a great place to start. So we're hoping to increase the numbers of people that we have involved in that collaborative. We discussed that we have different working groups. We're hoping to increase education around ACEs and attachment theory. There are so many ways that physicians can learn about this. And, you know, my way isn't going to be everyone else's way, but there is so much information. It's out there. We just really need to keep sharing. At this point, as a physician, you kind of need to look for it. You need to actually focus on it and make it a priority.
Thank you, Linda, for this really informative and powerful discussion. I hope that it will prompt physicians out there who are listening and others to look into this further, and all the very best to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been talking to Dr. Linda Ueda about adverse childhood experiences and how they impact the health and well-being of adults. For more information and resources on this topic, please check out the Doctors of BC website, also available in the notes accompanying this podcast. Thank you for listening.